Hello, everybody, and welcome back to We've Got Mail. This is the podcast where you control the conversation right here at the critically acclaimed network. My name is William Bibbiani. I am a critic, and everybody calls me Bibbs.
My name is Whitney Seibold. I, too, am a critic for the purposes of this particular podcast. And just this one. You may call me Rockmeister McCoom. That's my nickname. If you must use it, you can. But you don't have to. You can also call me Whitney.
Most people take advantage of this rare opportunity, and thank you for it.
Or, hey, you jerk. That works, too.
Also works good. Mm. And here's how this podcast works. You send us emails. Our email address is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. And if we get an email, we might read it on the show and answer your questions, respond to your criticisms, give you recommendations for things, tell you weird stuff about ourselves, whatever you want to know, really. We're pretty open books. We also have a P.O. box for those who are interested in that, people who like to send old-fashioned letters like you're in a Jane Austen novel. Whitney, what is... You know how Jane Austen was always writing to P.O. boxes? Like, Whitney, what is her P.O. box?
Write to Jane Austen, Critically Acclaimed Network, P.O. box 641-565, Los Angeles, California, 90064. That is our P.O. box. We've been getting junk mail in our P.O. box.
I've noticed!
It happens.
Yay! Our P.O. box is going to have its own Discover card.
Pretty much. It's gonna have 200 free AOL hours pretty soon. Evidently, the previous owner of our P.O. box like is still getting mail there. And yeah. I have no way of contacting this person.
No.
So I just have to throw away their mail.
Yeah.
It's nothing personal. It's just junk mail.
It's like to this person or current resident.
Right.
Like, even the person who sends the mail doesn't give a shit.
But they're on like some kind of weird mailing list for like super right wing magazines and stuff.
Ew.
About like, here's a magazine about how great Donald Trump is.
Ew.
Ew, woke culture, and everyone should have a gun. It's like really, really hardline stuff.
I only check our P.O. box like once or twice a week, so I think I've missed all that stuff.
Oh, well, be grateful. Yeah, that gets ripped up and thrown in the mail, but we're getting a lot of that stuff.
All right, well, let's not say we did. Before we get going, this is a very special episode of We've Got Mail. This is our 100th episode of this show.
It is.
Yeah, we've been doing this 100 episodes
now. Isn't that kooky? And
that's really great.
We should celebrate by answering some emails.
Yeah, we don't do anything special for our special episodes. I know some people do, like, wild and crazy things and bring on all kinds of special guests. We record at midnight, and that's just rude to ask anyone to even join in. So we're not going to do anything special. What's special is you. You send us your emails, and we want to give you all the time in the world. So we're just going to jump right in. We're doing business as usual, but we do want to say, before we get going, thank you to everybody who has been writing us this whole time, whether you've written in once or multiple times. We're just incredibly grateful to you. Thank you for wanting to chime in. Thank you for making your voice heard. This is a really, really fun show, and we wouldn't exist without you. So thank you from the bottom of our hearts. Let's dive in.
Okay, here is a letter from Eric.
Hi, Eric.
It's addressed to Dear B&W Root Beer Float. Isn't that cute? B&W, that's...
Got that. Okay.
Late. My wife's first name is Angie. My first name is Whitney. And we did consider at our wedding handing out N.W. merchandise.
I remember you talking about that. That would have been cute.
Too precious for us. We didn't want to go quite that
I think you could have had cans of A&W available at the tables. That wouldn't have been too bad. Wouldn't have been too bad.
I suppose not. We gave away books and records instead. That's what we were into.
That was a really good wedding, by the way. That's maybe the best wedding I've ever been to besides my own.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
Anyway, the letter says, this is in response to the letter you recently received asking for some good examples, stumbling out of the gate, some good examples of Filipino cinema.
Yeah, so in the previous episode, I think it was just the previous episode, someone asked for examples of Filipino cinema that really represented the culture well, and this is something that, you know, it's not my culture, it's not Whitney's culture, so we sent out the call to anyone who knew more about it than we did. So thank you for writing in. This
is great. I have a recommendation. It's a recommendation I'm sure you'll both be getting from a lot of other listeners. It's not a movie, but there is an anime based on Filipino mythology called Trese on Netflix, T-R-E-S-E. On Netflix, the show is based on a Filipino comic book of the same name. It's about a young girl named Alexandra Tresse, who works with the police department to solve supernatural crimes in Manila and the surrounding area. Some of the creatures featured in the series include a white lady ghost, a Nuno spirit that lives under a manhole cover, a duende tree spirit, a pair of Japanese twins who are part wind god, a Santelmo, and an Aswang street gang that is so large they refer to themselves as a nation. I am not Filipino, but I was stationed in the Philippines back in 1991 when I was in the Navy, and I love the country and the people as well as their traditional mythology. Good luck to the person who wrote you that letter. I'm looking forward to the other responses to this question. Signed, Eric.
Well, great. That's a great start. Thank you so much for your help, for your insight. I'm unfamiliar with that show, but that sounds cool. Mm-hmm. And it sounds like it's relatively easy to access, which is also great. So, bonus. Yeah,
if it's on Netflix, in the United States anyway. I don't know. I know streaming services are really dodgy around the world.
Yeah, you never know what's on what service in what country. But sometimes it's just, you know, you want to see a particular film from a particular country, and unless it had an official release in America, sometimes it's a little hard to get over here, and that can be really annoying. So, you know, not that it's not worth the effort, but, you know, bonus that it's available.
Yeah, a lot of streaming, it's been a lot better, especially if you're willing to go through, like, virtual cinemas of certain theater chains. Lemley's Monica has a really good virtual cinema. Yeah. Grasshopper Films and Icarus Films are really sort of carrying the torch and in international distribution here in the United States. They're gathered under the Ovid umbrella. So go check out Ovid. They have a lot of good Filipino cinema as well.
Awesome. Okay, well, let's move on. Thank you for writing in. Yeah.
Here's a letter from OK.
OK.
Signed off by OK. Dear Bibbs, and insert funny name for Whitney here. I don't need it. You can just call me Whitney. That's
no,
fine.
That's no fun.
I think so. My name is Whitney. You think I wasn't mocked relentlessly as a child?
This isn't mocking. This is playful joshing.
I went to like a ritzy private elementary school as well.
Did they have ritzy private school like insults?
Well, no, but they had like ritzy private school kids with weird ritzy school private school kid names.
My
name was Whitney. My sister's name is Heidi, which were like a little off the beaten path. But there was we had a brother and sister pair. Their names were Choya and Soharo after the cacti. All right,
that's cool. Those are cool names.
Two sisters named Jamila and Jopanky. That was pretty good. Whitney was hardly unusual with school with kids with names like that.
Yeah.
Anyway, you don't have to give me a funny name is my point. Right. OK says, I've been listening to your podcasts for over a year or so now. I find you both very insightful and smart, as well as giving an important perspectives and ideas on how to expand film viewing habits for someone like me, who's always way too into those Marvel films.
Well, thank you very much. I sense a butt coming.
Yeah. No, for example, even though I love Akira Kurosawa, I probably would have missed Dare Suzawa if it wasn't for you two mentioning it in one of your shows. I think it was both on the Iron List and on Episode Zero. I ended up loving that movie too, so thanks for recommending it. Now, a few weeks, months, what is time, ago in your letters, a listener was asking recommendations for movies that feature disabled actors or characters without the story being about their disability.
Yes. That was a bit ago, but yeah, that was great.
Now, the film I'm about to recommend is sadly very much about the character's disability, but I think it deserves some attention. The film is from my home country of Finland, and it was released here just this year. The name of the film is The Blind Man Who Did Not Want to See Titanic.
That's a great title.
I mean, who doesn't love a good 10-word title? The movie is about a man who's blind and uses a wheelchair due to MS disease, played by the actor Petri... Oh, gosh. Finnish names. Poikolainen, who himself has that same disability. In the movie, he wants to travel to another town to meet his girlfriend, who he's never met before, having only talked with her on the phone. But to get there, he has to rely on the kindness of strangers for his assistance. Because his assistant is too busy that day. The name of the film that comes from the fact that the character used to be a big film fan but never saw Titanic because of stupid film bro reasons. For me, the film paints a really good layered picture of its main character and shows him as a full person while also demonstrating the trouble he faces in ignorance and the ignorance of the people around him. The film is filmed in a really powerful way where the camera stays almost always near the main character, keeping things around him unfocused. Only when he touches something, it might become visible to viewers, getting the viewer as close as to the experience of the character as it can, while still being an interesting visual experience. I don't know if the film has a U.S. release date yet. I haven't heard of this.
No, I haven't. Sounds pretty good.
But I hope you and other listeners keep the blind man who did not want to see Titanic in mind if it pops up over there someday. For me, it was a really powerful experience and would love to hear whether or not people enjoy it if they end up seeing it, especially from disabled listeners. You probably have, as another able-bodied man, I don't have that perspective. Though I did read an article where this film was shown to a few people who did have MS, and they all liked it. The article was in Finnish, so I assume there's no point in sharing it here.
Well, appreciate knowing about it regardless. And yeah, is there more to the letter?
Yeah, a little bit more.
Okay, I'll let you finish.
This letter is already running longer than I thought it would. They always do. It's fine. We read them.
No one cares.
I seem to have trouble writing in more shorter manner. I hope my English was understandable and not so full of typos that it would make your eyes bleed. Anyway, thank you for your incredible work on your podcast and keeping me entertained during a full year of anxiety. Oh. I really love just putting your podcast on while relaxing and playing some mindless video games to keep my hands busy. Also, good luck to Bibbs on the Schmodown matches for the rest of the year, and I'm hoping to see Whitney play again in the future. With love and respect, okay.
Okay, thank you so much. A couple of things there. Firstly, yeah, going to Schmodown Spectacular, last match of the season, team's title match, up against King Arthur, so fingers crossed, hope to see everyone there.
He came back just to challenge you.
Just to challenge me. Yeah, I think I can take him.
His name is King Arthur. You should learn that.
The team is called King Arthur.
You should learn that little clapping hand movement
from
that the young Merlin did in The Kid Who Would Be King. He had this like very the signature gesture when he wanted
I will look that up.
To cast a spell. You should look that up.
That's fun.
And
I will
imitate
look it up.
That gesture. No one will get it, but it'll be fun.
If anyone does, they'll appreciate it. I will look into that. Thank you so much. I really wasn't even thinking of that. But what was I gonna say? Oh, I had a thing I was gonna say. I had a thing, and you totally derailed me.
About
was something else that they said?
The Finnish film.
The Finnish film sounds interesting, and thank you for the recommendation. But there was something they said after that, and now it's gone. It's gone forever. Something about thank you for listening, but that was nice. But that wasn't it. No, it's dead now. You ruined it.
He said he was listening. He was playing video games, listening to our podcast.
No, that wasn't.
Yeah, that was when.
That's nice.
And good luck on the Schmodown.
Yeah, that wasn't. There was something else. It's gone now.
Yeah, and I'll compete on the Schmodown again someday if they ever want me back.
Mm.
They have my number.
They do. They most certainly do. But yeah, no, it's gone. It would have been really fun to talk about.
Okay, well, let's move on. It'll come back as we move forward. And if it doesn't, we'll move on to other things. Okay. Here's a letter from The Windy. Hello, The Windy. We've heard from The Windy before.
Hello.
Hello, Sound Effects Man and Reading the Letters Man.
That's all I do. I just have the sound effects.
Do a horse and carriage on cobblestones.
No. It's complicated.
I just listened to your last letters episode, and one listener wrote in who described becoming anxious when they think about all the movie classics they might never catch up on. I definitely can relate. I got into movies only a couple of years ago and will probably never catch up. Maybe if they stop making new movies, but even then, probably not. So my approach, and I recommend this to everybody, is basically what Bibbs said. I am in a great situation to watch so many amazing movies for the first time. If I want to experience, to be surprised by a Hitchcock film or swept up in a Kurosawa epic, I don't know. I don't have to look very far. There's a huge pool of more than a century of cinema that I can dive into and find something that I don't know. So I don't think about FOMO. I see it as an opportunity. Signed, The Windy.
Yeah, I think it's a great way to look at it, too. I think I appreciate the eagerness that we all have to want to know as much as we can and have as many of the experiences as we possibly can and get really conversant in every single part of film. And I get it. I've gone through that too. And it's really, really great. But there's so much. There's so much I haven't seen. I've been doing this professionally, like being a film critic professionally for 10 years. I have been a full-time film fan for 30 years plus. There's still stuff I haven't seen.
Well, and even keeping up with the good things every year is difficult.
Yeah.
We see like 3 to 5 new films every week.
Give or take. Sometimes
and,
more.
But sometimes we get up and, we can get up into the tens. And I just made a list of all of the great films I heard like positive things about from critics I admire, things that I knew I wanted to see but didn't get a chance
from this
to.
Year.
From this year, and it's already 50 films.
Oh, I've got even more than that
on
mine.
And like all of the big awards contenders are still coming forth because we're in late November now.
The whole year.
It's super back-ended this year.
Yeah.
I mean, it always is, but it feels especially more so this year.
No, because like usually they would have spaced them out more like since like August or whatever, but here it's like they're just shoving them all into November and December.
Yeah, so
and it's just ridiculous.
So it's overwhelming. There's this gigantic crushing wave of all these films just from this year. Imagine also having the anxiety of keeping up with classics. Like I haven't seen every Hitchcock movie.
I haven't seen everyone. I've seen most of them.
I admire Kubrick for one reason and one reason alone. He made 13 movies.
Thanks, buddy.
That's manageable.
Yeah. It's not even hard to fit in AI on top of that. It's pretty great.
Thank you, Kubrick, for waiting a decade in between films. Same with Terrence Malick. It's like
or David Lynch. It's like all very manageable.
Yeah, you can keep up with filmmakers like that. And then you turn around and look at Takashi Miike and just say, fuck you. You made 8 films this year. Seriously, he's got like 105 films in his filmography.
There's definitely, when you become like a super fan of anything, this like collector's mentality starts ticking in, and you want to see it all. You want to like, even if you can't see everything, you want to see everything in a certain category. So you want to see like every movie in this franchise, or every movie this director ever made, or every movie this actor ever made, and that's really fun. And I still do that, and that's some stuff that we do on some of our shows, but. It's so much pressure.
Yeah.
It's so much pressure. And pressure, in my experience, doesn't help.
It doesn't add to your enjoyment of the thing.
No, some people it does, and I can't judge, you know, but like, and I'm definitely not saying if pressure helps you in some way, if that enhances the experience, more power to you, I guess. But in my experience and the experience I have talking to other people, feeling a lot of pressure to like catch up on things just makes it work.
Yeah.
And it shouldn't be work. It is art. Even when it's work, you have to remember, even when you make it your job, like we do, it's important every once in a while just remember like, hey, we get to watch movies.
We're supposed to be doing this for fun. Let's do this for fun every once in a while.
If we can't enjoy this job, there's no hope. The job is to see movies and talk about how good they are, like their place in history. It's not hard because, you know, there's a lot of involved scheduling and difficult to make money at and all that kind of stuff. All that stuff is true. But it's still a fun gig, so let's not rob it of that.
It's a fun gig until we have to watch Home Alone 6, and it's just painful.
Like they have those things online, like, for $1 million, could you watch Catwoman all day for 24 hours? And I'm like, yes.
Dude, I watched 3 Human Centipede movies. How strong do you think, how weak do you think I am?
Yeah, I could stand, it's not that bad.
I could stand just about anything at this point.
Yeah, seriously, if you give me $1 million to watch, and I hate the Human Centipede 3.
Oh.
If you gave me $1 million to watch that over and over again on a loop for a day, it would not be a fun day. It would be worth $1 million.
$1 million.
I would totally do that. Yeah, that's totally worth. Yeah, I'd do that. Like, that's not, it's not the physically most grueling job in the world. There are other considerations. So, especially if it's not your job, don't let it become your job. Like, don't let it become, let me rephrase. Don't let it become quote unquote work. Don't let it become a chore. I think that's what I'm getting at. Never let it become a chore. It's not worth it.
They shouldn't. I mean, sometimes they should feel like homework because some films do warrant that kind
homework
of study.
Homework can be fun,
but homework
if you enjoy
is
the topic.
Homework and study and delving in and letting your mind do that is indeed very fun.
Yeah,
I get through a lot of that sort of FOMO or the fact that you'll never catch up on every classic. By reminding myself that this is an incredibly modern phenomenon, the availability of a gigantic catalog of millions of films is only maybe 25 years old. Like before that, people had to like make do with what was playing at their local art houses. There were more theaters at the time.
Yeah, but
there
still
were a lot of repertory houses.
But they could only show so many movies. Yeah,
even then.
Yeah.
You
could catch on TV and like, but so, then it was, there was no DVR and they were edited and they were cut. They were trimmed for widescreen. Like,
what's more, I didn't get into movies until a little bit later than a lot of my peers. You know, you get to brag about seeing like Mrs. Miniver at 6. I didn't become obsessed with movies until I was like in high school or so. And when I
it's not a competition.
Really kind of dove in. But everybody, is going to have a different mental catalog growing up the kind of things you absorb should be different from other people's. You should see films that nobody else has seen.
Well,
you should skip classics that everybody else has seen because of your textured upbringing.
Yeah.
Is going to lead you to different stuff.
I mean, I don't know if it's okay. I don't know if should is the right word here, but you're going to regardless.
That's my point.
You should be proud of that. Yeah.
Yes. And,
I'm definitely going to skip Rebel Without a Cause. Fuck that movie. I'm going to be that guy. Like, I don't know if that's the attitude you take. But
if you don't want to see Rebel Without a Cause, or it's just not available to you for some reason, don't kill yourself. It's fine.
Well, never kill yourself. Well, but it's definitely not worth making a thing out of it. You'll get to it eventually if you want to.
My point is, I saw a lot of weird things growing up that only I saw that I got really attached to because they were things I got to discover.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was true of anybody growing up in a time pre-video stores. They would see whatever was playing at their local grindhouse.
Yeah.
They would see random midnight movies in the 70s. They would see whatever the big blockbuster was at the theater near them. And their mental catalog of the films they've seen was completely different from somebody living on the opposite coast.
I also think
that's okay. It's okay to have your own mental catalog. It's okay to be unique in that regard.
Yeah.
You don't have to memorize the syllabus. You don't have to look at the canon and fill in all of the boxes that everybody else has come together with.
Yeah. No,
you just can follow your passion and it's totally acceptable.
I love all of that. Mm. And I think there's something to be said also for especially when you're young and you're experiencing cinema for the first time, and you know, you're not gonna see you're not gonna see the first heist movie ever as your first heist movie. You'll see whatever the first heist movie you see is. Same thing for your first fight movie or your first rom-com or whatever. Those films can and should be important to you. Mm. And I think it's sometimes those first experiences where we see something, and maybe it's not the perfect example of something. Maybe it is flawed, but it can mean something deeply to you. And when movies mean something a lot to one or even just a few people, those movies have a lot of power, and then we can share how powerful that felt with other people. Mm. And then maybe other people will see those movies, which maybe aren't canonized, as truly valuable, and then we start getting different and interesting films as part of the conversation of films that really matter to us.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's good. It's natural. It's not something you have to seek out. It will just happen.
Yeah. Yeah.
So anyway, I guess my point is, don't worry about it. But again, these are all good perspectives. So let's move on.
Okay. Here's a letter from Ensign Gerbrandt. Hello, Ensign. Greetings, Captain Seibold and Commander Viviani. I guess I'm still the captain here.
Commander's below captain, right?
Yeah, first officer is commander.
Okay, so Commander Data. Data's a commander, right?
Data's a lieutenant commander.
Is that above or below
That's commander? Below. That's below commander.
I outranked Data. Yeah. Data, get me some coffee!
There are on Next Generation, there's only one captain on the ship, that's Captain Picard.
Right.
Commander Riker is a commander.
Yeah, is he the only commander?
And he's the first officer of... Dr. Crusher is also commander.
Okay.
Yeah, she holds the rank of commander.
Right. Okay.
I don't think we meet any other commanders.
Because both Riker and Crusher are the only ones who, under specific situations, can tell Captain Picard what to do.
Yeah, can pull rank on the captain.
Yeah, they're the only ones who can have that power. Mm-hmm. They have the power in different situations, but they can do it. Okay, cool. All right, I guess that makes sense. All right, moving on.
Montgomery Scott was lieutenant commander.
Sure.
But I think Dr. McCoy was also commander, addition to Spock. Anyway, dear Captain Seibold and Commander Viviani.
Yes.
Salutations from the USS Music Store in geosynchronous orbit above Winnipeg, Manitoba.
Well, it's a pleasure.
Yeah. See My Winnipeg by Guy Madden. It's a very good movie. No one here on my starship cares about Star Trek like I do. You're on a starship and they don't know about Star Trek.
Weird.
They're being brainwashed by some weird alien spore.
Just taking it for granted at that point.
There's another crewman who does adore the historical tapes that chronicle the adventures of the USS Enterprise D, but he refuses to watch the other records following the other crews unless it was in feature length format, and even then he has rather strong opinions. So I feel rather alone on lower decks because I'm unable to converse with anybody about this topic, and I hope you two high-ranking officers will allow this brief moment for me to speak freely. Star Trek Prodigy is garbage, absolute refuse, and an insult that all it was is and is to come from the Star Trek franchise.
Wow. That's a take.
New Star Trek is really rough going.
I'm getting that impression.
Lower Decks has come out swinging. They're bringing it.
I've seen a few episodes of Lower Decks and I really liked it. I saw the first one or two episodes of Discovery.
Mm.
wasn't really feeling it, but I heard it gets better. But anyway,
well, we'll talk about it.
We'll get there eventually.
Oh my Landru, this show infuriates me so much. I feel like the humanoids in charge of these new Star Trek shows have hit a new low. I thought Discovery was the worst it could be, but I feel like even that took. I think even they took that as a personal challenge to do even worse. Outside the whole Star Warsification of Star Trek, which is an ongoing issue, I think what angers me most is the fact that the show supposedly exists to introduce children to Star Trek. I remember sitting with my piano teacher's family in the living room waiting for my sibling to finish their piano lesson. It was then that I first was introduced to Star Trek and Captain Picard and Data. I was six. I was six when I first discovered Star Trek. Kids don't need an introduction to Star Trek. Star Trek is his own introduction. It's a pretty kid-friendly show.
I saw the first season whenever it came. I saw, I don't know, five or six when it first debuted. And honestly, the more I'm watching The Next Generation, rewatching it for our show All Yesterdays on our Patreon, it stuck with me. Like, I remember a lot of those episodes a lot better than I thought I did.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, they just, and that did create a connection to a lot of those characters, yeah.
I find myself very irritated when children's media speaks down to children. Mm-hmm. It makes it mind-numbing for the adults forced to live with the trash on in the background, but also doesn't challenge children to grow and mature. If we always try to put media at an equal level for children's comprehension, that will cause stagnation in their development. Now, I'm not arguing that we should throw children into the deep end and make them watch a Guy Madden movie when they're four. But introducing topics that will cause children to ask questions and having people willing to help answer these questions is so much better than the drivel Star Trek Prodigy is shoveling.
Wow.
Sorry, Captain and Commander. I think that the show is doing such an egregious sin against the franchise. I needed to vent a little bit. Sigh. Anyway, I hope you two are doing well. Please give my regards to Rear Admiral Luca. Sincerely, Ensign Gerbrandt.
Well, at ease, Ensign. And why don't you take some time on the holodeck and cool off?
There's two issues here. Yes, the Star Warsification of Star Trek. I brought up on a recent episode that the Star Trek movies, specifically the Next Generation films, lean way too hard into action when the Next Generation is not an action show.
I still think that's mostly First Contact and Nemesis. I really don't see...
Insurrection, there's like phaser battles, and it's about they do get to do cliched action movie
but
dialogue.
The premise
like,
is
time's
so,
up, and they blow something up.
But the
up.
Premise it's, is so dull. Like, it's really not that Star Warsy.
The premise is,
I'm not saying the problem with that movie is the premise. What I'm saying is the premise of that movie is not action packed, chasing a MacGuffin, fighting for your life all the time. It's about like a diplomatic issue. Like,
yeah,
and it's,
but
I'm not saying that. Like, I get it. I just feel like if that was your example of how Star Warsy Star Trek could get, it's not that much. I think First Contact, Nemesis, and definitely the Abrams movies are the prime offenders.
Well, the Abrams movies are the thing that really sort of pushed it over. And
well, Abrams even admitted he wasn't a Star Trek guy. He was a Star Wars guy.
So
he was
Star
making
Trek
him Star Wars-ish.
Star Wars.
Yeah.
And Forbes writer Scott Mendelson pointed this out, that the first two Abrams Star Trek movies, Star Trek and Star Trek Into Darkness, were big hits. I hate Star Trek.
Into Darkness, less so. Like, it didn't make as much money as you'd think.
Less so, but it still made its money. Yeah, yeah. It was
there was this general sense that those movies should all be making $1 billion, and I'm like, I think this show's a little bit more niche than you're thinking.
But
like, they were, that's what they were aiming for. They were trying to be a big mainstream
success. Star Trek Beyond, rather notoriously, wasn't as big a hit as those first two, and some people said, oh, they were sort of tired of that universe by then, whatever the reason, but Scott Mendelson pointed out, the reason those first two were a big hit was because they looked a lot like Star Wars, and we didn't have Star Wars at that point.
Disney hadn't bought
it, and Star Wars The Force Awakens came out in 2015. I think Star Trek Beyond was that year or the next year. So the idea that we have Star Wars now, we don't need a Star Wars version of Trek now.
Yeah.
So using Trek as sort of like this Star Wars crutch to get
even when
the
you think about like when the original series films were coming out, we only had a couple of Star Warses.
Yeah,
you know, it wasn't like they were all on home video, or there were like six movies or nine movies or TV shows or whatever. We had a couple of Star Wars movies. There was room for more.
So Star Trek was filling a different need, and when they and there was this big political battle, and I'll very briefly, there was a split in Viacom between CBS and Paramount, so they became two different entities. CBS had the show, Paramount had the movies.
Yeah.
And the movies had to be legally different from the show. Like, it was in the contracts, I think, for toy reasons.
Yeah.
So when it came time to make a new movie, they deliberately had to make it very, very different from what Star Trek was.
It had
was.
To look different. The costumes had to be different. Like, all those changes were not arbitrary. They were important.
Nobody knows what the actual contract says. Well, I mean, people know what they... Like, the public, it's not, the public doesn't know what the actual contract says, but the rumored number was it had to be, like, at least, like, 20 to 30% different. I don't know how you measure that sort of thing.
That's a
ridiculous
figure, but yeah.
And then those films were big enough hits that when it came time for CBS All Access, now known as Paramount Plus, came out, they decided to sort of roll with that vibe. It's like, we want this to be, Star Trek is now an action show.
Well, if that many people want to see that movies, we want them coming in here and watching the show.
Yeah,
and we don't want them to come here and watch the show and find something nerdy. So we will make something more action-packed to suit that audience. Yeah.
And not only is it action-packed now, and it's full of special effects and rapid-fire phasers and stuff and no diplomacy and people killing and cussing and it's just super violent now. It's also really, really badly written. Those are not good not good action scripts even. So it's a big, big problem. And I understand what's happening with Prodigy as well.
Have you watched Prodigy?
I've watched every episode of Prodigy to date.
And
there's only five episodes as of this recording.
No, real fast. I haven't watched this yet, but it's my understanding that it's about a bunch of young kids from different alien species who end up like taking charge of a starship, and they're being sort of trained by a hologram tutorial version of Captain Janeway.
Yes, the kids are escaped mining slaves.
Ah!
They come from a Star Wars mining planet, and they look like Star Wars species. In fact, some of the characters look like Star Wars, like specific Star Wars characters.
So they're not like Federation cadets. They're just random people who managed to steal a Federation type starship.
They're looking for a lost Federation starship. Okay. It's called the USS Protostar, and they find this ship and they steal it. They abscond with it, and there's an Emperor Palpatine is on their tail. Essentially,
that's not a bad hook.
And there's a Darth Vader on their
that's
tail.
That's not a bad hook.
Well.
A bunch of noobs end up on a starship, and there's a hologram of a famous captain helping him out. That's not bad. That's a good start.
This was about the kids discovering Starfleet principles, or if you wanted to go like the education bent, and it was more about sort of astral facts and here's what a nebula is and here's what happens to the life cycle of a star.
Yeah, I like
that.
Would have
been cool. That would have been cool too. But
both of those things are cool.
But it's an action show. It's about chases and escapes. You can have some action.
They're being pursued. I guess that's okay. But like, you still want it to embody the principles of Starfleet, because here's people who are not part of Starfleet. It'd be cool to have them learn that.
It's Star Wars characters on a Starfleet vessel. It's essentially asking who would win in a fight, which has never really been the Star Trek thing. That's the Star Wars thing.
Yeah, the answer is Star Trek, by the way.
I remember my favorite comedian Greg Proops was once asked, what's better, Star Wars or Star Trek? And he says, well, I was in Star Wars. So Star Trek. Greg Proops played one head of a two-headed alien doing the announcement at the pod race in The Phantom Menace.
He got to yell things like, it's Skywalker!
Yeah.
Admittedly, I would totally jump at that gig too.
Oh, absolutely!
That's a fun gig. I don't care what it is. I'd totally do that.
And he was going to do it with his head was going to be in live action and then superimposed on like an alien body.
Yeah.
So there's pictures of him like in this like really wild alien makeup doing the voices.
And then I just do it with CGI.
And then they just did it with CGI instead. So the CGI thing looks awful.
Yeah.
But second point of that letter was the aiming more sophisticated media at a child audience means having to make it simpler or less sophisticated or less intelligent or less complex.
That's one take people seem to have. And I actually am totally with the Ensign here, where I actually think that for the most part, young people want to be older. Being young sucks. We romanticize it because...
I liked being young.
Okay. I'm exaggerating for comedic effect. Being young can be wonderful. Being young can also be very harrowing. All right? You don't have a lot of control over your life. Everyone's always telling you what to do. There's a reason why Home Alone works as a movie. It's because it's a fantasy about not having any adults around.
Yeah.
All right? You're vulnerable. You have no power. You have no money. You have no legal... like rights, you can't like vote or anything like that. I mean, you have rights, but you don't have any power in the system. No one listens to you. there's a lot of downsides to being young. So I find often when young people gravitate towards a fantasy, the fantasy usually involves either being older or having responsibilities of older people.
Yeah.
You know, having power, being like, you know, this, that was the fundamental fantasy behind He-Man. Here is this scrawny kid. Or at least that was the idea. Then ended up drawing him the same way as He-Man because they were lazy. But here's a kid, and then he gets a magic sword, and now he's powerful.
Mm.
That's the fantasy. I think that's one of the reasons why Ghostbusters succeeded. Not because of the movies. The movies were hits. The animated series was something that made it seem like an aspirational thing. You two could have this day job. And there would be so many great adventures, and it'd be super cool. That kind of thing. And a lot of those episodes didn't talk down to the audience.
There were kid episodes.
There were kid episodes. It got more kid friendly as the series went on. But the first 50 or 70 episodes of that show are actually pretty much like all ages, reasonably intelligent.
I've made the mistake of going back, and it's not nearly as good as I remember.
No, but for a kid, it's better than a lot of the stuff that was out there. Is my point. We gravitated towards stuff like that because it was a little smarter, a little bit more aspirational, just a little bit more "quote unquote" adult than what else was available now. But that's something that I think it's something kids crave is to be treated with a little bit more respect. And I think when you have a show that does that, I think it's hard for kids to ignore it.
Yeah. The thing is, you look at sort of the American film media landscape, and the talk tends to circle around superheroes all the time. Let's ask Jane Campion about superheroes now. I don't care what Jane Campion thinks about superheroes. Ask her about her movies.
That's an absurd question. What does that have anything to do with what she's doing?
Hey, Tsai Ming Liang, what would you do with Spider-Man? It's like, Spider-Man would sit in a chair for 5 minutes not doing anything.
There was a gag someone did. They did like a fake mock-up of a Variety headline. Why Alfred Hitchcock will never make a superhero movie. And it was one of those classic, like Hitchcock things where him holding his hands like, and it's just, the quote is, "I'm dead."
So, it's always a gotcha question. Always gets our gets us up in a dender, and it's designed to do so, and it works. But you'll notice that that's where the attention is, and that kind of story is where most of the conversations are being led. And those are very simple stories.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of moving parts in them, but there's not a lot of complicated ideas in them. There's not a lot of challenging concepts being introduced to these things.
Yeah.
And in fact, if one of these movies comes out and it does challenge sort of superhero status quo, they tend to get a little bit pilloried by certain critics or certain audiences.
That doesn't mean they do it well.
Not necessarily, but they're like the villain twist in Iron Man 3, I thought was actually kind of clever for as these stories kind of go. And
a lot of people
reacted negatively to that because it was, I don't know, maybe too unexpected.
But I think you also end up with things like, say, Batman v Superman, which even in its director's cut, tries to bring up all these ideas about morality or whatever, and it kind of just does them really badly.
Well, because
in a really thudding way. It does it in an immature fashion.
It kind of like skirts up to the question and says, wow, that's a profound question. Yeah, could you ask it? And then maybe have a discussion about that? Answer it in some significant way?
No, we're too busy being tough.
Yeah.
Cool.
The movie's far too testicular it is Dionysian and not Aristotelian. Skew into Nietzsche for a second.
I am not qualified to co-host this show anymore.
You know what those words mean.
I'm vaguely aware.
But
I can Google it.
Yeah, this idea that things need to, like, media needs to be widely accessible to the most number of people is a very, very recent concept, because the biggest hit films tend to be accessible to kids as well as adults.
Yeah, the films that everybody might have an interest in, as opposed to it's guaranteed to only be interesting to one group.
And all of that is four-quadrant thinking. It's that we have to appeal to the greatest number of people, which means we can't make it too kiddified. Because we want, like, slightly older kids, because grown-ups wouldn't want to see that.
Yeah.
But we can't make it too sophisticated either, because then kids wouldn't want to see it.
Yeah.
And this is studio thinking, by the way. And,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
So as such, we get this very limited range of types of ideas that are getting into our feature films.
Yeah, well, maybe we'll brush up against big ideas, but we won't actually deal with them very
I was shocked to learn how few films were rated G these days.
Yeah, it's weird, right?
Like, there's like less than 2 dozen in the last couple of years. Clifford the Big Red Dog was rated PG.
Yeah.
So like you had to toughen up Clifford the Big Red Dog.
I don't remember what they did. Did they just have like a couple of like...
I guess
the dog pees on a tree, but dogs do that.
Somebody might have said the word damn a couple times.
I was having this conversation, I think it was about Clifford, but maybe it was something else, but like this whole idea that, you know, you don't want films that are rated G because... Yeah, adults won't want to see them.
Not on their own, anyway.
Well, there's a stigma against rated G, like sort of the opposite of how there's a stigma against like NC-17. Like, it's just too limiting in what the audience might be interested in just based on the rating alone. And the weirdest example of that, and we'll move on after this, but the weirdest example of that is Gillian Armstrong's Little Women.
The 94 version.
The 94 version with Winona Ryder and Christian Bale and Kirsten Dunst and Susan Sarandon. Great movie. Genuinely great movie. It's rated PG. My mom was a teacher throughout the 90s and most of the 2000s, and she loved this movie and she wanted to show it in her classroom because it's a very good adaptation, it's very age appropriate for everybody, and she couldn't because it was PG, and in an elementary school and public school you're only allowed to show a G-rated film getting like permission slips.
Okay.
So if it's G, it's fine. If it's not G, it's not fine. So she couldn't show this movie because it's PG. And it baffled her. And so, like, hey, listen, we need to rent this movie and we need to watch it. And we literally watched it and we took notes and we paused it. We were trying to figure out why is this rated PG. And then finally we were able to find, this is before like the internet made this readily available, the notes from the MPAA for why it is rated PG. Language. You will not find milder language than in Little Women.
Based on Louise May Alcott's... What, are they going to throw in like a motherfucker or something?
There's not even a damn in this movie. The closest thing we found is there's a one scene where both Amy and Joe use the word blast. Like, blast it. Mm. And they are chided for using slang. And then at one point, and maybe this is it, they say like...
Darn tootin' language.
Yeah, basically. And then at one point, I think Joe says someone like, oh, don't chastise me for that. You're being a ninny pinny. And it's like, and I'm like, this is it? It's not even like, I've seen like movies that were like rated PG for like
thematic stuff.
Mature themes. And if you wanted to
somebody dies or they discuss divorce, there's a death
in Little Women. There's a death in Little, without ruining or telling who it is, there's a death in Little Women and it's intense.
Hmm.
If that was the reason, I would be like, okay, I think you're exaggerating it, but you know, whatever. That's an intense scene. No. Language. There's no harsh language in it. I can't find it anywhere. It's absurd. But they wanted the PG, so they just made up a reason for it. It's nonsense.
It is nonsense. And this goes to this kind of flattening out and this homogeneity when it comes to a lot of popular entertainment now. Yeah. And, you know, Star Trek Discovery on their you know, sort of edgier edge or a little bit R-rated. There's like a little bit of nudity and there's a lot of cussing and violence. That's nudity? The thing that's... Yeah, there's nudity in the new shows. There's Klingon nudity in Star Trek Discovery.
Finally.
Yeah.
What?
And it's the new Klingons, so they look completely different from what you're used to.
I think it's an arbitrary choice, but whatever, yeah.
I
just want Michael Dorn to just come in and see the new Klingons like, we do not talk about it.
In the second season of Discovery, they said, yes, we didn't have hair in the first season because we shave our heads in time of war. Oh, do you, asshole? Yeah. Oh, God. It's just so on the harder edge, we have like Star Trek Picard, where they say things like, shut the fuck up in Picard. And people are smoking and drinking and murdering each other.
Finally, it's edgy and have a reason to watch it.
So that's clearly like it's R-rated, but it's meant to appeal to like the edgy teens who clearly feel like Star Trek is a little too gentle. And now we have the gentle Star Trek and Prodigy, but we're still hovering around 11 to 17. That's where most of popular entertainment is right now. We can't reach beyond or below that. And that's really frustrating. It's
because
I want more than that. I'm 43. I don't want things for 11 to 17 year olds.
I think we're going to reach a point, I don't know when, I hope it's soon, where the people who, like, listen, so much media is made for people who are in their teens to, like, their late 20s. This kind of halcyon era where you have a lot more income than you have actual responsibility. That's fine. There's a lot of movies and media that appeal to people, particularly in that age demographic, that I can still enjoy as someone who is rapidly approaching 40, and I know other people who are older than I can enjoy it too. The problem is that we also just keep getting older, don't we?
Yep.
So, like, I can enjoy stuff that I enjoyed in my 20s or that other people wouldn't enjoy in their 20s, but I'm also interested in stuff that speak to me now. But the media only wants to talk about stuff for people in their teens and 20s, and we're constantly getting more of them. It's not like we're aging out and isn't anyone left in their teens. No, we're cycling through.
People are having less kids.
People are having less kids.
I'm interested to see where that's going to be in a generation.
But my point is this. So much of entertainment media is, and just to keep a specific example, is focused on the teen to 20-something demographic. Because there's a lot of it, and I get it. But the people who used to be in the teen and 20-something demographic, who are getting older and, if not necessarily more mature, certainly more experienced, and certainly...
It's a very, very diplomatic way of putting it.
I think that's a fair way of putting it, where you don't necessarily have to be wise, but you've lived longer, you've gone through more, different stories will speak to your experience. And they're not going to necessarily be this stuff for teenagers. And we're missing this opportunity to start focusing more on that stuff that appeals to people in their 40s and 50s because they still watch movies. It's not like I hit 40, I don't watch movies anymore.
No.
Maybe you don't watch as much, but you watch, right?
And I was really frustrated because when I hit 30, I was like, okay, you know what? I can start putting this stuff away. I don't have to pay as much attention to comic book stuff. And that's like right when like this big surge of superhero stuff started to come in. And like the rise of geek media and geek journalism became really, really huge right around the time I was turning 30. And people were grabbing me by the collars and saying, no, you don't have to put your kid's stuff down, but I want you. No, pick it up again. It's like, oh, well, okay, fine. The Infinity Gauntlet is like...
It's really a metaphor for...
It's like, so I...
Socialism? I don't know.
Like, can I write about Dostoevsky instead? No!
Find a way to make it about Star Trek!
Yeah, so... Yeah. And
the old Star Trek, the new one.
Make it new and edgy. So I appreciate... We have gone on and off quite a big tangent here, but I think this is all really significant.
It is. Let's just move on.
Yeah, anyway, demographic...
There's no end to this conversation.
Here's a letter from Jeremy.
Hi, Jeremy.
Dear Bibbs and Rockmeister, I'm writing from Calgary, Alberta, Canada, Canadian letter, nice. Where our cinematic claim to fame is Cool Runnings was shot here.
I like Cool Runnings. You finally saw Cool Runnings not that long ago. It's pretty good, right?
It's pretty good, yeah. It's a totally effective sports movie.
Yeah.
I went to college in Tacoma, Washington. Tacoma, Washington's claim to fame was The Hand That Rocks the Cradle House was nearby.
Ooh, creepy house.
And then, of course, I moved back to L.A., where it's like something is being shot on every street corner.
Yeah.
First of all, I love your podcast, and I think they keep the spirit of really insightful film criticism alive. Keep up the good work.
Thank you.
You very much. Now on to my question. There always seems to be some ongoing discourse concerning how filmmaking is a young person's game. Oh, this ties in. Most directors finish their careers with subpar films that are below their normal standards. I often wonder how valid this criticism is. Looking back at the careers of some of my favorite directors, I would say a lot of their later films were some of the more interesting and assured pieces that they've made. I would even go so far as to say a lot of directors' final films, such as Altman's A Prairie for Home Companion, Lubitsch's Clooney Brown, Sergio Leone's Once Upon a Time in America, and Yasujiro Ozu's An Autumn Afternoon could stand among their best work. I even think so-called lesser films like Hitchcock's Family Plot and Billy Wilder's Buddy Buddy have their moments and are worth discussing. I think there are some exceptions to the rule, but I think it's important to know that some directors simply struggle by not having the resources or clout once granted to them in their younger years.
Yeah.
Part of the problem might come down to ageism. Once you grow older, your opinions no longer matter, and you're pegged as old-fashioned. However, I do not believe being older makes you automatically out of touch or passé. Spielberg, Scott, I'm guessing Ridley Scott, and Scorsese, for example, are all in their 70s. Scorsese's in his 80s. And are making some of the best films of their careers. Anyway, I was just wondering, what are some of your thoughts on this topic? Does this argument hold any water? Should directors be put out to pasture once they have peaked? What are some of your favorite final films from great directors? Thanks so much and keep up the great work. Regards from Canada, Jeremy.
Yeah, this does connect, actually. And I think you hit the nail on the head on some of it, where if you haven't made, and this is true for anyone regardless of age, if you haven't made a hit film lately, it's harder for you to get projects off the ground. Mm-hmm. Especially projects that you're really passionate about. You might have to do one for the studio and hope it makes money, mm-hmm. and then you can have a little bit more clout and can do something. We have a little bit more control, a little bit more daring.
Spielberg wasn't allowed to make The Post unless he made Ready Player One.
Yeah, Spielberg has trouble making movies. I know he's still making great movies, mm-hmm. but he's having trouble making movies. Yeah, that's sad.
John Waters gave up.
Yeah.
He
hasn't made a movie since
Dirty Shame in 2004. Shame. Yeah. It's been a while since he made a film. I mean, he's at peace with it. He doesn't want to do it anymore, yeah, but
he's happy,
gave up. He gave up, that is, making movies. Yeah. He likes writing books and doing art shows and
he's still very
tours.
Busy. Yeah.
But yeah, he was trying to get money together for a Christmas movie.
Oh,
can you imagine
God,
that? The John Waters Christmas movie was going to be called Fruitcake.
I want to win the lottery and throw money at him. Please, just do Fruitcake.
It was a musical about orphans who steal meat. And Johnny Knoxville was going to be their Artless Dodger kind of leader character.
All right, I'm ambivalent about Johnny Knoxville, but other than that, it's fine.
Well, he was in a Dirty Shame, so it was
not. I've got no objection to Johnny Knoxville. It doesn't make me go, ooh, fine.
I think Johnny Knoxville's really way more interesting now that he's a little older.
I agree.
But yeah, he couldn't get funding. No one would give him funding. Because A Dirty Shame tanked pretty horrendously. It was rated NC-17. Nobody would carry it. Dirty Shame is fine. I like A Dirty Shame a lot, actually. Mm. But yeah, he gave up a lot of older filmmakers. That is over 60, I think.
Yeah, they just struggle working in the studio system.
They
yeah.
start to have trouble getting it. We have talked in the past about the whole generation of horror filmmakers.
Yeah,
John Carpenter, Joe Dante,
George A. Romero really struggled.
Yeah. These people couldn't get funding for their movies. Why not? They had a lot of huge hits just 15 years ago.
I remember I was actually hearing a story about how when George A. Romero wanted to do the first Resident Evil movie, he wanted to do it.
Mm-hmm.
He was super excited about it. Yeah, I think he had a script and everything. And apparently they were like, he hasn't made a hit movie in a while. And I'm like, no, what are you talking about? He did Creepshow. He did The Dark Half. He did, he made hit films.
Even Land of the Dead was a hit.
Well, that was after the Resident Evil thing he was working on. Oh, but yeah, he made hit films.
Mm-hmm.
It's nonsense. But it's always, what have you done for us lately?
Yeah.
And there is ageism involved here. I think there really is. And I think one of the reasons why some people argue that some of the great filmmakers go out on some of their worst movies, I think... is because a lot of times filmmakers who have long careers end with mature movies. They're not necessarily
older people's concerns, perhaps.
Even look at someone like Stanley Kubrick. Stanley Kubrick died while in post-production on Eyes Wide Shut. And there was a lot of talk about Eyes Wide Shut. It had two of the hottest movie stars in the world, Tom Cruise and Nicole Kidman. It was going to be NC-17. It was going to be sexy as hell. And you watch it, and it's actually a really mature film about marital jealousy.
Yeah. Yeah.
And if you haven't experienced
Eyes Wide Shut is excellent, by
the way. It's a great movie. It's brilliant. And but it's a movie that you can get it when you're younger, but it's only after you've understood what jealousy does to a relationship and how long-term relationships can be affected by attraction or the desire to stray, if you must put it that way. These are mature ideas, and they are not for people who just thought A Clockwork Orange was badass.
Well, first of all, Clockwork Orange is not badass.
You know what I mean? It's, you can appreciate a Clockwork Orange on a surface level.
I understand what
you're
saying.
You can appreciate Dr. Strangelove on a surface level. There is no surface level where Eyes Wide Shut is fun.
Yeah, I suppose
it's not a fun film. It's not supposed to be.
Well,
the thing that people took from Eyes
Wide Shut was the masked party, and that's sort of the pop culture image that became the more accessible thing.
Yeah,
they're even joking about that. And
that's what orgies look like in movies now.
Yeah, what was the title of the Kumail Nanjiani Issa Rae?
Lovebirds.
Lovebirds.
Yeah,
yeah. They had an Eyes Wide Shut orgy in that movie as well. Kurosawa's last film was called Madadayo, Madadayo, and which means not yet. And it's about an old man who is he's dying. He's that's his toast. It's like, are you dead yet? No, not yet. And that is about coming to terms with the end of your life. And it was something that Kurosawa made when he was 70, at the end of his life.
Let's see. Orson Welles had two, actually. Before he died, the last film he ever completed was a film called F for Fake, which is as vibrant a movie as he ever made. And it's actually a very fitting quasi-documentary about charlatans, and it also relates it directly to his career as a filmmaker, which is a kind of fakery, and also his own career, which was based on a lot of duplicity. And it's really, really cool and honest and open. And then after he died, they finally finished a movie he had almost completely shot called The Other Side of the Wind, which is also incredibly vibrant and alive, and is also very much a look back at his own career, but it's very critical of it, I think, and I think it's very good. And so that's a favorite. Those are both last movies, and they're both favorites.
Here's what's really strange. A certain age, I was talking about how Hollywood films are getting talked about when they're aimed at a certain demographic, and a lot of people are sort of zeroing out on those movies and having that level of a conversation. Those same people are also canonizing movies and creating the discourse around what films should be taught in colleges and grow up and put these things on syllabi. Mm-hmm. I saw a tweet recently of I wish I knew the source, but it was a litany of the names of the filmmakers that are still to this day being taught most in college courses.
Oh, yeah, I saw this too.
And it was like a bar graph. And Hitchcock was like way ahead, like double the second place person.
Yeah.
And you go down, and it's the same people I was being taught in the 90s.
Yeah, like the exact same motherfuckers. There's only two people of color
One black man, it was Spike Lee. There was one Asian man, it was Kurosawa. And there was one woman, and it was Leni Riefenstahl.
Leni Riefenstahl. We haven't moved on from Leni. If you don't know the name, she made the documentary Triumph of the Will about why Nazis were great.
Yeah, yeah.
We need to move the fuck on from Leni Riefenstahl. Everybody else was right there. Varda's amazing.
Please teach Agnes Varda in film schools.
There's so many female filmmakers.
So yeah, that's just to sort of point out the lack of diversity in film educations. Yeah. But you know, these syllabuses were made by younger men. And I feel like when somebody like Scorsese or Spielberg passes away, not putting a curse on it, just, you know,
it's going to happen someday, hopefully in a long time.
I feel like Scorsese's more recent films have been a lot more interesting. Look at The Irishman. Okay, you could have shaved maybe 20 or 30 minutes out of the driving sequence But the fact that it is about these guys having their exhilarating rise and also their eventually just sort of dissipation into old age makes that film incredibly fascinating.
Yeah.
I like looking at Spielberg, who has gotten increasingly political as his career has progressed. And I feel like films like Lincoln and The Post are among his best work.
I think he started deciding to become like America's like historical chronicler, I think he ended a really interesting phase.
I think
those are really great films for the most part.
I think making AI made him sort of like break out into this new plane, and I think his films after that became a lot more different than what he was doing previously.
I think he was leaning in that direction. I think Amistad is leaning in that direction. It's not as good.
Amistad is this big, schlocky Hollywood production.
I agree, but I think he's trying to get there, is my point.
Maybe.
I think,
I don't like Amistad.
There's stuff I like in it, but fair enough.
But when they pass away and their obituaries are written, with Spielberg, the first film they're going to list is Raiders of the Lost Ark. They're going to list Jaws. They're going to list the films that he came to prominence over and the films that are still part of the young person's pop culture conversation. Mm-hmm.
These are the films that are seen as influential and such.
Yeah.
The canon is, for shitty reasons, almost entirely history. Cinema history is only a little over 100 years old. Like, in the grand scheme of things, that's nothing. That's nothing compared to most art. And yet, that so much of that time, it was either hard for non-white men to get movies made, or if you were able to get movies made, it was hard to get them seen and sort of appreciated by the critical community, which was mostly white men. And as a result, when we tend to focus on the history of cinema, like here's your broad overview of the history of cinema, you're going to get the same movies from white male filmmakers over and over again, many of which are great films. That's neither here nor there. Oh, yeah. But it's extremely narrow-minded and narrow-focused. And we need to expand on that canon. And I think that's true also as well for which films we decide to canonize in films with large careers. At the end of the day, as great as Raiders of the Lost Ark is, I think it is not one of Spielberg's most interesting movies.
No.
It's a great movie. You should totally watch it.
I adore Raiders of the Lost Ark.
And if we were making a list of his best, it would be on there. If we're making a list of his most interesting, not in my top 10.
No. Like I've said, I think Lincoln and The Post are both not just good movies, but like kind of important.
Yeah.
That speak to the politics of the day as well as like featuring great performances from grand actors from Hollywood's like oldest life.
I would put Empire of the Sun up
actually,
there.
Actually, I haven't seen Empire of the Sun.
So good. I think you really like it. But like he's made hell, 1941 is an interesting view of the 1940s with a very different lens than he would take in something like Saving Private Ryan. And I think that's more interesting.
Yeah, the problem is when we talk about films generally, and this is me going off on a tangent, but I want to say it. The films we tend to talk about from the past and the ones we talk about the most are the ones that resemble what we're into now. We're really into big sort of pop culture fight movies right now, big comic book movies. So when we talk about movies from the past, it's all of the pop culture-y stuff that tends to get the most press, right? We're remaking Ghostbusters now, for God's sake.
I guess,
What are the best movies of the 1980s? Back to the Future and Ghostbusters. And these are good movies. These are fine.
Yeah.
Why aren't we talking about how big comedy films were in the 1980s? Because we're not watching comedies now. I think if we were watching comedies now, we would start looking back through our own cinematic past through that lens, and we'd be picking up different things, and we'd be letting other films sort of fall by the wayside. We'd be, suddenly, remember when Crocodile Dundee was huge?
It was huge.
Crocodile Dundee was enormous. Three Men and a Baby was the highest grossing film of 1987, the year it came out.
Which is the highest, nonsense.
The highest grossing film of 1983 was Jurassic Park. Do you know what the second highest grossing film was that year?
Of 1993? Was it Schindler's List? Because that was the same year.
Schindler's List is a little further down the list. It was Mrs. Doubtfire.
Oh, there you go.
A comedy film. And again, those are domestic, and that's... My point is... We're focusing on, this is true that there is ageism sort of over film history, and this has always been a problem, but I feel like when we look at the filmographies of aging filmmakers today, we're only focusing on what they did as young men because they made certain types of...
They made young men movies.
Young men pop entertainments, and that's what we're talking about right now, young men pop entertainments.
Yeah.
And I think once trends shift, the way we look at film history will also shift.
All it takes to break out of this, and this is something everyone can do, is to... You don't have to stop talking about what's contemporary. You don't have to do that. It's contemporary, it's relevant now, everyone's talking about it. You just have to make a concerted effort to talk about the other stuff, too.
Yeah.
Like, as much. Just talk about stuff that doesn't fit in that bubble. Talk about genres that aren't popular right now. Talk about movies that don't have this giant nostalgia wave connected to them from the past.
Yeah.
If we can just keep that going and popularize that, then these movies won't die. And eventually, they'll just pick up more steam as more people have heard of them, and it's more common to talk about them. This is how movies get rediscovered. This is how movies get canonized over time. They just don't leave the conversation. That's it. That's all there is. They don't leave. They don't have to be the biggest hit when they come out. They just don't leave. You can be the biggest hit ever, and no one's talking about you in 5 years. You're not part of the canon. That's what matters. So just talk about it. And you can do this every single day on Twitter and your regular life. Just make sure you talk about other types of art than the stuff that's currently trendy. And that's nothing wrong with being trendy. Lots of great things can be trendy, but we can't let that completely overshadow so much of film history. Yeah. It's not fair. Anyway, I think that's it.
Do you want to do one more?
We'll do one more. It's our 100th episode. We'll do one more
later. All right. Here's a letter from The Brain.
Ooh.
Hello, The Brain. I read your letters however you sign them off, by the way. If I don't read your name out of the subject
line. I will just add in a hearty narf.
Dear Bins and Meister the Rock McCool.
Okay.
I think it was supposed to be Bibs. It says Bins. I'll call you Bins.
That's fine.
You spoke about podcasts and ads that are not on the same page as your thoughts and feelings. We're running ads now.
Yeah.
We're on a different...
we're part of the fan-sided network.
Yeah, we're on a different network now.
So yeah, we're preceded by and post-seeded by ads now. That's true.
Yeah.
So it's new. It's weird.
You spoke about, and we had an ad that we objected to, and we had asked that they pull it down.
Yeah.
I remember listening to a Marvel podcast when The Inhumans came out. I remember Inhumans. Week two, Marvel bought ad space where the podcasters had to do live reads. The podcasters felt much the same way as everybody else did about Inhumans. Then they had to do a live read promoting the show after lambasting at the beginning of the show. To their credit, they were still completely honest with their feelings of the show after reading the copy that was sent to them, but it was awkward.
Yeah.
Anyway, the question I have is, I've been trying desperately to look at older movies, and I want to ask which ones I would make me lean in with a schlock horror that I can find on streaming.
Okay.
As a side note, I can't wait for you guys to have an episode called, an episode of Cancel Too Soon for La Brea. do you notice there's a new show called La Brea and another new show called Fairfax.
I know, it's weird, right?
Yeah.
I wanted the crossover.
Oh,
But they never do. They're actually parallel streets.
But going back to Star Trek for a minute, there was...
Wait, no, they don't. They crossover. La Brea and Fairfax?
No, they run parallel.
They run parallel? La Brea's... And La Brea...
No, if you're going east on the 10, you hit the Fairfax exit, and then you hit the La Brea exit. They run parallel. They both run east... both run north-south.
You're right. I don't know why I thought Fairfax is... You're right. Yeah, it's late.
There's no
it's
intersection.
Late. I totally forgot Los Angeles geography.
You know what? Maybe there's like someplace out in like way out in like Claremont or something where they intersect. But
it doesn't happen.
But to go to Star Trek for a minute, there was
of course,
because
I found a way.
The makers of Lower Decks, the class of ship on Lower Decks is called California class, and they name all of the ships out of after like dinky towns in California. So the main ship is the USS Cerritos. They also run into the USS Merced at one point, which is a little nothing town. There's also the USS Solvang, which is so nice you can't wear shoes on the carpet.
That's a very funny.
Those are like little in jokes for California residents. And they said, well, Star Trek Discovery takes place like 1,000 years in the future. What does the California class look like then? So here's the USS Mid-Wilshire. Which is a neighborhood in LA. It's not even a city.
That's hilarious.
Like, yeah, they'll run out of cities, so they'll just name it after LA neighborhoods. So here's the USS Mid-Wilshire really made me giggle.
That's a funny joke. Anyway, what was the we got distracted on here.
The show is like schlock horror recommendations that you can find on streaming. Well, I'm going to go on Shudder right now.
I'm sure we can find a lot.
Yeah, there's a lot. Shudder is very carefully curated. Mm-hmm. It's not a huge library, but it's a good library.
It's a very focused library, and if you're looking for just horror stuff, it's a very, very good place to start.
And they have what they do on a lot of streaming services do this. They categorize their films. Shudder is all horror, but it's like here's all of like the found footage movies, but it's around Thanksgiving. Here's all of the horror movies about bad families, so you can watch Devil's Rejects, that kind of thing. And they have a really good back catalog of kind of horror essentials. Let's see. I'm actually looking at Shudder Essentials right now. They have Mara Bava's Black Sunday.
Ooh, good one.
Carnival of Souls. If you haven't seen Carnival of Souls, that's public domain. You can find it anywhere.
It's also a bit more classy than maybe you're thinking of, but it's really good.
Yeah, it's not so schlocky. Yeah. Day of the Dead, Frankenhooker, the original Halloween, the original Hellraiser, House on a Hill, William Castle film. These are all just... You can't go wrong with a lot of these. A lot of them you probably have seen. They even have both versions of Nosferatu.
Nice. I was going to recommend, and it's currently on Criterion.
Ooh, okay.
Dr. X from Michael Curtiz.
It's on Criterion.
It's on Criterion at the moment.
Dr. X is excellent.
And there's so much schlocky horror from the early sound era. That is so much fun. Like, the rules weren't really solidified yet as we knew them, and they were just doing these big, giant swings. Dr. X is about a serial killer and a mad scientist decides to solve the crime by bringing all of his scientists.
All the other mad scientists in.
Yeah, all the mad scientists are going to be in one room, and we're going to strap them down, and we're going to recreate the murder right in front of them, and whichever one gets, like, really horny or something is going to be the one. And it's like, and where that plot goes, you will not predict,
because
it's really wild.
It's really, yeah, it's a clever script. It was shot in this, like, early color process, so it's glorious. Looks really fantastic.
It looks like a dream. It looks like a dream color. It's so damn cool. There's
also Dr. X. I'm fond of from the, if we're, you know, sticking around the 30s, I really love Island of Lost Souls.
Yeah, you finally got me to watch that. That movie's great.
It should be listed with Universal Horrors. It's Paramount Film, but it's
it feels like it
should be one of the Universal Horror movies.
Yeah.
But yeah, Charles Laughton plays Dr. Moreau, and he's been using vivisection to turn animals into people, and it is twisted and nightmarish. Yeah. The Criterion Edition has an intro from Mark Mothersbaugh of Devo, because they adopted the Are We Not Men as their slogan. So that was enough to get Devo involved.
Over on HBO Max, another horror film, early horror film from Michael Curtiz, which is schlocky and wonderful, is Mystery of the Wax Museum.
Okay.
Which most people know House of Wax, the Vincent Price movie, which was a gigantic smash hit. A lot of people remember, and for some reason are really fond of, the Paris Hilton remake, which... is not good. It's not Paris Hilton's fault. I'm not a fan of that one. But
I don't understand the affection for that film. It's not good.
I don't get it either. But anyway, but I digress. The original, first off, it's done in that incredible, like, two-strip Technicolor process. So all the colors are a little bit off and weird, and it's wonderful. But it's creepy. And Faye Ray plays a plucky reporter that would make Lois Lane jealous. She's so damn cool in it. And it's pre-production code, so it's extra violent and crazy, and it's so good. I want to say,
look up the Old Dark House.
I'm not gonna look. I think Old Dark House is still on Shudder. I could be wrong. But you I'll look it up too, I guess. But I want to make sure it's available somewhere relatively easy to find. It's not streaming anymore. You might be able to find it online somewhere.
The Old Dark House is also on Shudder.
Yeah, that's what I thought. I wanted to recommend this a great silent horror film called The Unknown, about starring Lon Chaney Sr. as Alonzo the Armless, an armless knife thrower who falls in love with a woman who is afraid of being touched, and she's played by Joan Crawford, young Ooh, Joan okay. Crawford. But the twist is Alonzo actually has arms, because he's actually on the run because he's a murderer, and he's been pretending to be an armless knife thrower, and now he's going to have his arms surgically removed so that he can be with Joan Crawford.
Oh, God.
And it's like a Tales from the Crypt episode. Everything goes horribly ironically wrong. It's really twisted and weird. It's so cool.
I guess that's what you'd call a real farewell to arms.
Oh, nice. There's so much good schlock out there, and there's so much good schlock horror, and I think most people, when they think about schlock horror, tend to go back as far as maybe the 60s. Mm. Go back earlier. There's so much fun, weird stuff.
Well, and just throughout.
There's no shortage.
As many people critics have pointed out, horror is like the mainstay in cinema. It's like the one genre that is just always going to be chugging along.
It's one of the first genres that came to cinema.
Some genres like kind of rise and fall in popularity. Some are really big, and then they just sort of fall out of favor. Horror always percolates at like number three.
Always does well.
It always does well. It's always interesting. So you're going to find a lot of interesting stuff if you go back through the history of the genre, schlocky and otherwise. There's too much to go into right there, so I'm just going to point you toward Shudder. I think Shudder is really kind of the best place to find a pretty decent baseline schlock education. If you want to go a little bit deeper, go to Night Flight, because they have Night Flight is a streaming service that people don't talk about nearly enough. $40 for a whole year. They have old episodes of Night Flight, the TV show, which used to be on USA, and they showed, it was a place to get, like, specially curated music videos, a lot of rock interviews, interviews with filmmakers. But they also have contracts with, like, Arrow Video and, like, other specialty horror Blu-ray labels. So they have, a lot of really interesting, deep-cut, sick cult movies on there as well.
Nice.
As well as, like, tokusatsu films and like Jerry Anderson shows. There's a lot of really interesting stuff on Night Flight.
Cool.
If you want to get high and watch Gumby reruns, you can go on Night Flight.
There's really no other way to consume Gumby reruns.
I suppose not. Yeah, it has to be after midnight, and you have to be high as fuck, and then you can watch Gumby. I'm not a weed guy, but that seems right to me.
No, you're on the trolley, yeah. Anyway, I hope that helps. Please let us know what you think. If you do track those movies down, feel free to write us in to tell us about that. Or you can find us on Twitter at Critic Acclaim. I'm at William Bibbiani.
I'm at Whitney Seibel.
If you want to write in to this show, again, we gave you the email at the top, but here it is again. letters@criticallyacclaimed.net is the email address. We don't have time to read every letter, but we read as many as we can. Whitney, what is our P.O. box again?
It's Critically Acclaimed Network, P.O. Box 641565, Los Angeles, California, 90064.
A huge shout out to our patrons. If you've been enjoying all the conversations we've been having about Star Trek lately, we got a Star Trek podcast over there reviewing every single episode of Star Trek. There is an over 100 episode backlog where if you sign up for that tier, that all that's readily available for you. That's a giant, giant swath of for lack of a better word, content. That's just right there for you. We also have a podcast we're reviewing every single film ever nominated for Best Picture, every single episode of 1960s Batman, commentary tracks. We do hangouts with our patrons. There's a lot of stuff over there. And we hope you're enjoying it. We're very, very grateful for every single patron that we've got. And it means the world to us that you think we're worth it. So thank you from the bottom of our hearts. And of course, don't forget the holidays are coming up. Maybe you'll want to give someone some soap. Doesn't have to be a statement. It could just be nice. You know, like, hey, here's some soap. It doesn't have to be your stinky. Like, here's some nice soap for the holidays. And why I bring this up, because I, myself, and my partner, I'm Lapis De Silva. We have a soap store on Etsy. We design handcrafted soaps. They smell amazing. There's a lot of cool holiday stuff available for the season. And also, our classics are readily available as well. We've been restocking them for the season. So head on over to Salt Cat Soap on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook. We're also on Etsy. Just look for Salt Cat Soap, all one word. A lot of cool stuff coming. We're going to have a Black Friday sale coming up this next week. So stick around. Cool stuff.
And I have a Christmas radio show coming as well.
I'm super excited about this.
It's still in the midst of being made, so no release date as yet. But it'll be out in time for Christmas.
Yay! All right. Well, anyway, stick around for that. And again, if you're at our top tier on Patreon, you get all of Whitney's radio dramas for no additional fee. But if you do want to have them anyway, contact him via social media, and he can set up a thing on Venmo or something like that.
I can email you an MP3 and you can pay me with the usual means.
Yeah, usual stuff. Yeah. Anyway, that's it for We've Got Mail. Thank you, everybody. This episode's like usually in the middle of the week, but this week it's at the end of the week. So have a great weekend. Enjoy yourself. Be safe. Take care of each other. And sincerely yours, Bibbs and Whitney.